Imagination can make a person think he is in love, and love thus becomes the second strongest force. We should call it controlled imagination. Whatever we call it, we must always remember, in any battle between the will and the imagination always wins. In the East we do not bother about willpower, because willpower is a snare, a trap, which chains men to earth. We rely on controlled imagination, and we get results. If you have to go to the dentist for an extraction, you imagine the horrors that await you there, the absolute agony, you imagine every step of the extraction. Perhaps the insertion of the needle, and the jerking as the anesthetic is pumped in, and then the probing about of the dentist. You imagine yourself fainting, or screaming, or bleeding to death, or something. All nonsense, of course, but very, very real to you, and when you get into the chair you suffer a lot of pain which is quite unnecessary. This is an example of imagination wrongly used. That is not controlled imagination, it is imagination run wild, and no one should permit that. Women will have been told shocking tales about the pains, the dangers, of having children. At the time of the birth the mother-to-be, thinking of all these pains to come, tenses herself, makes herself rigid, so that she gets a twinge of pain. That convinces her that what she imagined is perfectly true, that having a baby is a very painful affair, so she tenses some more, and gets another pain, and in the end she has a perfectly horrible time. Not so in the East. People imagine that having a baby is easy, and painless, and so it is. Women in the East have their babies, and perhaps go on with their housework a few hours after, because they know how to control imagination. You have heard of brainwashing as practiced by the Japanese, and by the Russians? That is a process of preying upon one's imagination, and of causing one to imagine things which the captor wants one to imagine. This is the captor's method of controlling the prisoner's imagination, so that the prisoner will admit anything at all, even if such admission costs the prisoner's life. Controlled imagination avoids all this because the victim who is being brainwashed, or even tortured, can imagine something else, and then the ordeal is perhaps not so great, certainly the victim does not succumb to it. Do you know the process of feeling a pain? Let us stick a pin into a finger. Well, we put the point of the pin against the flesh, and we wait with acute apprehension the moment when the point of the pin will penetrate the skin and a spurt of blood will follow. We concentrate all our energies on examining the spot. If we had a pain in our foot, we would forget all about it in the process of sticking a pin in a finger. We concentrate the whole of our imagination upon that finger, upon the point of that pin. We imagine the pain it will cause to the exclusion of all else. Not so the Easterner who has been trained. He does not dwell upon the finger or the perforation to follow, he dissipates his imagination, controlled imagination, all over the body, so that the pain which is actually caused to the finger is spread out over the whole of the body, and so in such a small thing as a pinprick it is not felt at all. That is controlled imagination. I have seen people with a bayonet stuck in them. They have not fainted, or screamed, because they knew the bayonet thrust was coming, and they imagined something else, controlled imagination again, and the pain was spread throughout the whole body area, instead of being localized, so the victim was able to survive the pain of the bayonet thrust. Hypnotism is another good example of imagination. In this the person who is being hypnotized surrenders his imagination to the person who is hypnotizing. The person being hypnotized imagines that he is succumbing to the influence of the other. He imagines that he is becoming drowsy, that he is falling under the influence of the hypnotist. So, if the hypnotist is sufficiently persuasive, and convinces the imagination of the patient succumbs, and becomes pliable to the commands of the hypnotist, and that is all there is to it. In the same way, if a person goes in for auto-hypnosis, he merely imagines that he is falling under the influence of himself. And so he does become controlled by his greater self. This imagination, of course, is the basis of faith cures. People build up, and build up, and imagine that if they visit such and such a place, or are treated by such and such a person, they will get cured on the instant. Their imagination, in such a case, really does issue commands to the body, and so a cure is effected, and that cure is permanent so long as the imagination retains command, so long as no doubt of the imagination creeps in. Just one more homely little example, because this matter of controlled imagination is the most important thing that you can ever understand. Controlled imagination can mean difference between success and failure, health and illness. But here it is, have you ever been riding a cycle on an absolutely straight, open road, and then ahead of you seen a big stone, perhaps a few feet from your front wheel? You might have thought, oh, I can't avoid that. And sure enough you could not. Your front wheel would wobble, and no matter how you tried you would quite definitely run into that stone just like a piece of iron being drawn to a magnet. No amount of willpower at all would enable you to avoid that stone. Yet if you imagined that you could avoid it, then avoid it you would. No amount of willpower enables you to avoid that stone. Remember that most important rule, because it can mean all the difference in the world to you. If you go on willing yourself to do a thing when the imagination opposes it, you will cause a nervous breakdown. That actually is the cause of many of these mental illnesses. Present-day conditions are quite difficult, and a person tries to subdue his imagination, instead of controlling it, by the exercise of willpower. There is an inner conflict, inside the mind, and eventually a nervous breakdown occurs. The person can become neurotic, or even insane. The mental homes are absolutely filled with patients who have willed themselves to do a thing when their imagination thought otherwise. And yet, it is a very simple matter indeed to control the imagination, and to make it work for one. It is imagination, controlled imagination, which enables a man to climb a high mountain, or to fly a very fast plane and break a record, and do any of those feats which we read about. Controlled imagination. The person imagines that he can do this, or can do that, and so he can. He has the imagination telling him that he can, and he has the will willing him to do it. That means complete success. So, if you want to make your path an easy one and your life pleasant in the same way as the Easterner does, forget about willpower, it is just a snare, and a delusion. Remember only controlled imagination. What you imagine, that you can do. Imagination, faith, are they not one? Chapter 5 The Other Side of Death. Old Tsong Tai was dead, curled up as if he were asleep. We were all sick at heart. The ward was hushed with sympathy. We knew death, we were facing death and suffering all day long, sometimes all night long too. But old Tsong Tai was dead. I looked down at his lined brown face, at the skin drawn tight like parchment over a framework, like the string drawn tight on a kite as it hummed in the wind. Old Tsong Tai was a gallant old gentleman. I looked down at this thin face, his noble head, and the sparse white hairs of his beard. Years before he had been a high-ranking official at the palace of the emperors in Peking. Then had come the revolution and the old man had been driven away in the terrible aftermath of war and of civil war. He had made his way to Chongqing, and had set up as a market gardener, starting again from the bottom, scratching a bare existence from the hard soil. He had been an educated old man, one to whom it was a delight to talk. Now his voice was stilled forever. We had worked hard to save him. The hard life which he had proved too much for him. One day he had been working in his field, and he had dropped. For hours he had lain there, too ill to move, too ill to call for assistance. They had come for us eventually, when it was too late. We had taken the old man to the hospital and I had tended him, my friend. Now there was nothing more that I could do except see that he had burial of the type that he would want to have, and to see too that his aged wife was freed from want. I lovingly closed his eyes, the eyes that would no longer gaze at me quizzically as I plied him with questions. I made sure that the bandage was tight around his jaws so that his mouth would not sag, the mouth that had given me so much encouragement, so much teaching in Chinese and Chinese history, for it had been my wont to call upon the old man of an evening, to take him little things, and to talk with him as one man to another. I drew the sheet over him and straightened up. The day was far advanced. It was long past the hour at which I should have left, for I had been on duty for more than 17 hours, trying to help, trying to cure. I made my way up the hill, past the shops so brightly lighted, for it was dark. I went on past the last of the houses. The sky was cloudy. Below in the harbor the water had been lashing up at the quayside and the ships were rocking and tossing at their moorings. The wind moaned and sighed through the pine trees as I walked along the road toward the La Masurie. For some reason I shivered. I was oppressed with a horrid dread. I could not get the thought of death out of my mind. Why should people have to die so painfully? The clouds overhead scurried swiftly by like people intent on their business, obscuring the face of the moon, blowing clear, allowing shafts of moonlight to illuminate the dark fir trees. Then the clouds would come together again and the light would be shut off, and all would be gloomy, and dark, and foreboding. I shivered. As I walked along the road my footsteps echoed hollowly in the silence, echoed as if someone were following me close behind. I was ill at ease, again I shivered and drew my robe more tightly around me. Must be sickening for something, I said to myself. I really feel most peculiar. Can't think what it can be. Just then I came to the entrance of the little path through the trees, the little path which led up the hill to the La Masurie. I turned right, away from the main road. For some moments I walked along until I came to a little clearing at the side of the path where a fallen tree had brought others crashing down. Now, one was flat upon the ground and the others lay at crazy angles. I think I'll sit down for a moment. Don't know what's happened to me, I said to myself. With that I turned into the clearing and looked for a clean place upon the trunk of a tree. I sat down and tucked my robes around my legs to protect me from the chill wind. It was eerie. All the small sounds of the night broke in upon me, queer shudders, squeaks, and rustles. Just then scurrying clouds overhead parted, and a brilliant beam of moonlight flooded into the clearing, illuminating all as if in the clearest day. It seemed strange to me, light, moonlight as bright as that, as bright as the brightest sunlight. I shivered, then jumped to my feet in alarm. A man was approaching through the trees at the other side of the clearing. I stared in utter incredulity. It was a Tibetan Lama. A Lama was coming toward me with blood pouring from his chest, staining his robes, his hands too were covered with blood, dripping red. He walked toward me, and I reeled back and almost tripped over the bole of a tree. I sank down and sat in terror. "Lobsang, Lobsang, are you afraid of me?" a well-known voice exclaimed. I stood up, rubbed my eyes, and then rushed toward that figure. "Stop," he said. "You cannot touch me. I have come to say goodbye to you, for this day I have finished my span upon the earth, and I am about to depart. Shall we sit and talk?" I turned, humbly, heartbroken, stunned, and resumed my seat upon the fallen tree. Overhead the clouds whirled by, the leaves of the trees rustled, a night bird flitted overhead intent only on food, upon prey, oblivious to us, and our business. Somewhere at the end of the trunk upon which we sat some small creature of the night rustled and squeaked as it turned over rotting vegetation in search of food. Here in this desolate clearing, wind-swept and bleak, I sat and talked with a ghost, the ghost of my guide, the Lama Minyadondup, who had returned from beyond life to talk to me. He sat beside me as he had sat beside me so many times before away in Lhasa. He sat not touching me, perhaps 3 yards distance from me. "Before you left Lhasa, Lobsang, you asked me to tell you when my span upon earth has finished. My span has now finished. Here I am." I looked at him, the man I knew above all others. I looked at him and I could hardly believe, even with all my experience of such things, that this man was no longer of the flesh, but a spirit, that his silver cord had been severed, and the golden bowl shattered. He looked to me to be solid, entire, as I had known him. He was dressed in his robes, in his brick-red cassock with the golden cloak. He looked tired as if he had traveled far and painfully. I could see well that for a long time past he had neglected his own welfare in the service of others. "How one he looks," I thought. Then he partly turned, in a habit that I so well remembered, and as he did so I saw a dagger in his back. He shrugged slightly and settled himself, and faced me. I froze with horror as I saw that the point of the dagger was protruding from his chest, and the blood had poured from the wound, had run down and saturated the golden robe. Before it had been as a blur to me, I had not taken in the details, I had just seen a llama with blood on his chest, blood on his hands, but now I was gazing more closely. The hands I saw were blood-stained where he had clutched himself as the dagger came through his chest. I shivered and my blood ran cold within me. He saw my gaze. He saw the horror in my face, and he said, "I came like this deliberately, Lobsang, so that you could see what happened. Now that you have seen me thus, see me as I am." The blood-stained form vanished in a flash of golden light, and then it was replaced by a vision of surpassing beauty and purity. It was a being who had advanced far upon the path of evolution. One who had attained Buddhahood. Then as clear as the sound of a temple bell, his voice came to me, not perhaps to my physical ears but to my inner consciousness. A voice of beauty, resonant, full of power, full of life, greater life. "My time is short, Lobsang, I must soon be on my way, for there are those who await me. But you, my friend, my companion in so many adventures, I had to visit you first, to cheer you, to reassure you, and to say farewell for a time. Lobsang, we have talked so long together in the past on these matters. Again I say to you, your way will be hard, and dangerous, and long, but you will succeed in spite of all, in spite of the opposition and the jealousy of the men of the West. For a long time we talked, talked of things too intimate to discuss. I was warm and comfortable. The clearing was filled with a golden glow, brighter than the brightest sunlight, and the warmth was the warmth of a summer noon. I was filled with true love. Then, suddenly, my guide, my beloved Lama Minya donned up, rose to his feet, but his feet were not in contact with the earth. He stretched out his hands above my head and gave me his blessing, and he said, "I shall be watching over you, Lobsang, to help you as much as I can, but the way is hard. The blows will be many and even before this day has ended you will receive yet another blow. Bear up, Lobsang, bear up as you have borne up in the past. My blessing be upon you." I raised my eyes, and before my gaze he faded and was gone, the golden light died and was no more and the shadows of night rushed in and the wind was cold. Overhead the clouds raced by in angry turmoil. Small creatures of the night chattered and rustled. There was a squeak of terror from some victim of a larger creature as it breathed its last. For a moment I stood as if stunned. Then I flung myself to the ground beside the tree trunk, and clawed at the moss, and for a time I was not a man in spite of all my training, in spite of all I knew. Then I seemed to hear within me the dear voice once again. "Be of good cheer, my Lobsang, be of good cheer for this is not the end. For all that for which we strive is worthwhile and shall be. This is not the end." So I rose shakily to my feet, and I composed my thoughts, and I brushed off my robe, and wiped my hands from the mud on the ground. Slowly I continued my journey up the path, up the hill, to the Lamasery. "Death," I thought, "I have been to the other side of death myself, but I returned. My guide has gone beyond recall, beyond my reach. Gone. And I am alone, alone." So, with such thoughts in my mind I reached the Lamasery. At the entrance were a number of monks who had just returned by other paths. Blindly I brushed by them, and made my way along into the darkness of the temple where the sacred images gazed at me and seemed to have understanding and compassion on their carven faces. I looked upon the tablets of the ancestors, the red banners with the golden ideographs, upon the ever-burning incense with its fragrant swirl of smoke hanging like a somnolent cloud between the floor and the high ceiling far overhead. I made my way to a distant corner, to a truly sacred spot, and I heard again, "Be of good cheer, Lobsang, be of good cheer, for this is not the end and that for which we strive is worthwhile and shall be. Be of good cheer." I sank down in the lotus position, and I dwelt upon the past and upon the present. How long I stayed thus I do not know. My world was toppling around me. Hardships were pressing upon me. My beloved guide had gone from this world, but he had told me, "This is not the end, it is all worthwhile." Around me monks went about their business dusting, preparing, lighting fresh incense, chanting, but none came to disturb my grief as I sat alone. The night wore on. Monks made preparation for a service. The Chinese monks in their black robes with their shaven heads with the incense marks burned into their skulls, looked like ghosts in the light of the flickering butter lamps. The priest of the temple in his five-faced Buddha crown came chanting by as the temple bugles were sounded and the silver bells were rung. I slowly rose to my feet and made my reluctant way to the abbot. With him I discussed what had happened, and asked to be excused from the midnight service, saying that I was too sick at heart, too unwilling to show my grief to the world of the Lamasery. He said, "No, my brother. You have cause to rejoice. You have passed beyond death and returned, and this day you have heard from your guide, and you have seen the living proof of his Buddhahood. My brother, you should not feel sorrow, for the parting is but temporary. Take the midnight service, my brother, and rejoice that you have seen that which is denied to so many." Training is all very well, I thought. I know as well as any that death on earth is birth into the greater life. I know that there is no death, that this is but the world of illusion, and that the real life is yet to come, when we leave this nightmare stage, this earth, which is but a school to which we come to learn our lessons. Death? There is no such thing. Why then am I so disheartened? The answer came to me almost before I asked myself the question. I am despondent because I am selfish, because I have lost that which I love, because that which I love is now beyond my reach. I am selfish indeed, for he who has gone to glorious life, while I am still ensnared in the toils of the earth, left to suffer on, to strive on, to do their task for which I came in the same way as a student at a school has to strive on until he has passed his final examinations. Then with new qualifications he can set forth unto the world to learn all over again. I am selfish, I said, for I would keep my beloved guide here upon this terrible earth for my own selfish gain. Death. There is nothing to be afraid of in death. It is life of which we should be afraid, life which enables us to make so many mistakes. There is no need to fear death. There is no need to fear the passing from this life to the greater life. There is no need to fear hell, for there is no such place, there is no such thing as a day of judgment. Man judges himself, and there is no sterner judge than man of his own infirmities, his own weakness, when he passes beyond life on earth and when the scales of false values drop from his eyes and when he can see truth. So all you who fear death know this from one who has been beyond death, and has returned. There is naught to fear. There is no day of judgment except that which you make yourself. There is no hell. Everyone, no matter who they are, nor what they have done, is given a chance. No one is ever destroyed. No one is ever too bad to be given another chance. We fear the death of others because it deprives us of their well-loved company, because we are selfish, and we fear our own death because it is a journey into the unknown, and that which we do not understand, that which we do not know, that we fear. But, there is no death, there is only birth into a greater life. In the early days of all religions that was the teaching, there is no death, there is only birth into the greater life. Through generation after generation of priests the true teaching has been altered, corrupted, until they threaten with fear, with brimstone and sulfur, and tales of hell. They do all this to boost up their own power, to say, "We are the priests, we have the keys of heaven. Obey us or you will go to hell." But I have been to the other side of death and have returned, as have many lamas. We know the truth. We knows that always there is hope. No matter what one has done, no matter how guilty one may feel, one must strive on for there is always hope. The abbot of the Lamasery had told me, "Take the midnight service, my brother, and tell of that which you have seen this day." I dreaded it. It was indeed an ordeal for me. I felt sick at heart. The terrible oppression sat upon me, and I returned to a secluded corner of the temple to my meditation. So that terrible evening wore on, with the minutes feeling like hours, with the hours like days, and I thought I should never live through it. The monks came and went. There was activity around me in the body of the temple, but I was alone with my thoughts, thinking of the past, dreading the future. But it was not to be. I was not to take the midnight service after all. As my guide, the Lama Minyadon Up had warned me earlier in the evening, another blow was yet to fall before the day was ended, a terrible blow. I was meditating in my quiet corner, thinking of the past and of the future. At about 11 o'clock of that night, when all was quiet around me, I saw a figure approaching. It was an old Lama, one of the elite of the Temple of Lhasa, an old living Buddha who had not much longer to live on this earth. He approached from the deeper shadows where the flickering butter lamps did not penetrate. He approached, and about him was a bluish glow. Around his head the glow was yellow. He approached me with his hands outstretched, palm up, and said, my son, I have grave tidings for you. The inmost one, the L3th Dalai Lama, the last of his line, is shortly to pass from this world. The old man, the Lama who visited me, told me that the end of a cycle was approaching, and that the Dalai Lama was to leave. He told me that I should make full haste and return to Lhasa so that I could see him before it was too late. He told me that, then he said, you must make all haste. Use whatever means you can to return. It is imperative that you leave this night. He looked at me, and I rose to my feet. As I did so, he faded, emerged back into the shadows and was no more. His spirit had returned to his body, which even then was at the Jokang in Lhasa. Events were happening too quickly for me. Tragedy after tragedy, event after event. I felt dazed. My training had been a hard one indeed. I had been taught about life and about death, and about showing no emotion, yet what can one do when one's beloved friends are dying in quick succession? Is one to remain stony-hearted, frozen-faced, and aloof, or is one to have warm feelings? I loved these men. Old Tsongtai, my guide, the Lama Minyadon Dup, and the L3th Dalai Lama, now in one day within the space of a few hours I had been told one after the other was dying. Two already were dead, and the third. How long before he too went? A few days. I must make haste, I thought, and I turned and made my way from the inner temple into the main body of the Lamasery. I went along the stone corridors towards the cell of the abbot. As I was almost at the turning for his room, I heard a sudden commotion and a thud. I hastened my footsteps. Another Lama, Shi, also from Tibet, not from Lhasa but from Chembo, had had a telepathic message too, by a different Lama. He, too, had been urged to leave Chongqing and to return with me as my attendant. He was a man who had studied motor vehicles and similar forms of transit. He had been rather too quick. Immediately his messenger had departed, he had jumped to his feet and raced down the stone corridor towards the abbot's cell. He had not negotiated the corner but had slipped upon some butter which had been spilled from a lamp by a careless monk. He had slipped and fallen heavily. He broke a leg and an arm, and as I turned the corner I saw him lying there, gasping, with a shaft of bone protruding. The abbot came out of his cell at the noise. Together we knelt beside our fallen brother. The abbot held his shoulder while I pulled on his wrist to set the broken bone. Then I called for splints and bandages, and soon she was splinted and bandaged, arm and a leg. The leg was rather a different matter because it was a compound fracture and we had to take him to his cell and apply traction. Then I left him in the care of another. The abbot and I went to his cell where I told him of the message I had received. I described to him the vision, and he, too, had had a similar impression. So it was agreed that I should leave the Lamasery then, at that instant. The abbot quickly sent for a messenger who went out at a run to get a horse, and to gallop full speed into Chongqing on a mission. I stopped only to take food and to have food packed for me. I took spare blankets, and spare robe, then I made my way on foot down the path, past the clearing where earlier that evening I had had such a memorable experience, where I had seen for the last time my guide, the Lama Minyadon Dup. I walked on, feeling a sharp pang of emotion, fighting to control my feelings, fighting to maintain the imperturbable mien of a Lama. So I came to the end of the path where it joined the road. I stood and waited. Behind me, I thought, in the temple the deep bronze gongs would be calling the monks to service. The tinkle of silver bells will punctuate the responses, and the flutes and the trumpets will be sounding. Soon upon the night air came the throb of a powerful motor, and over the distant hill came the bright silver beams of headlamps.